ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय Canto 4, Chapter 25, Text Number 44. This chapter is entitled The Characteristics of King Puranjana. Upagiyamano lalitam tatra tatra chagayatke kridan parivrita sribir Radhinim avichas chucho. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. Many professional singers used to sing about the glories of King Puranjana and his glorious activities. When it was too hot in the summer, he used to enter a reservoir of water. He would surround himself with many women and enjoy their company. Purport. A living being has different activities in different stages of life. One stage is called Jagrata, or the life of awakening. And another is called Svapna, or the life of dream. Another stage is called Sushupti, or life in an unconscious state. And still another stage occurs after death. In the previous verse, the life of awakening was described. That is, the man and the woman were married and enjoyed life for 100 years. In this verse, life is the dream state is described. For the activities Puranjana accomplished during the day were also reflected at night in the dream state. Puranjana used to live with his wife for sense enjoyment, and at night this sense enjoyment was appreciated in different ways. A man sleeps very soundly when he is greatly fatigued, and when a rich man is greatly fatigued, he goes to his garden house with many female friends and there enters the water and enjoys their company. Such is the tendency of the living entity within this material world. A living entity is never satisfied with a woman unless he is trained in the system of Brahmacharya. Generally, a man's tendency is to enjoy many women. And even at the very end of life, the sex impulse is so strong that even though one is very old, he still wants to enjoy the company of young girls. Thus, because of the strong sex impulse, the living entity becomes more and more involved in the material world. During this auspicious Kartik month in Sri Vrindavan Dham, we are continuing on the story of King Puranjana, who we can all take lessons from, not being inspired by, but to take lessons from. And we are going through in these chapters the different phases of experimentation that King Puranjana is going through. Of course, we know it's an allegorical story. It's very symbolic in many ways, and Prabhupada is kind enough at every step to show us what is the meaning of each allegory so that we don't lose track of who is King Puranjana and who is the woman and who are the snakes and what are the gates and what is that city, because these are the different stages that we have to go through when we take on the journey of studying the Srimad Bhagavatam. Even though the Srimad Bhagavatam is Amala Puranam and it is exclusively written for the Paramahansas, the objective and the goal of the study of Srimad Bhagavatam is to attain the highest stage of pure devotional service. But to get there, we have to hear of different stories and all the different obstacles that one has to face before reaching realization that Lord Sri Krishna is Swayam Bhagavan, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and that our eternal relationship with Him is based on pure devotional service. So the story of King Puranjan in the fourth canto of Srimad Bhagavatam is a perfect example how Shukadev Goswami is still teaching not only the sages of Nimisharanya but also all of us today how to be very careful about the nature of this material world. And symbolism and allegories are found in all the different religious scriptures of the world. Oftentimes there is a conflict between the scholars and the academics who tackle religions and tackle spiritualism purely and essentially on wanting facts. They want historical facts. Did this actually happen? In other words, did Puranjan ever exist? Did the city of the Nine Gates located geographically anywhere? Can we locate it in time? Is there a chronology? All these things are of great importance for people to decide whether something is true or not. Even in Judeo-Christian doctrines, the main emphasis is on chronology and basic facts, whether things really happened or not. Academics and scholars are more baffled when they tackle Vedic scriptures. Why? Because those who are involved with Vedic scriptures, those who speak the knowledge of the Vedas, are not really concerned with chronology, they're not concerned with geography, they're not concerned with time. They're concerned with essence, and they're concerned with the lessons to learn. And therefore it is very difficult for scholars to actually try to work out the reality of the Srimad Bhagavatam. And this is good in one sense. It's good because it clears the path for those who are very sincere and those who are serious about spiritual life to have access to the essence of the Vedas. And those who are maturely motivated, and this point is the very, very first verse of the first canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, where Srila Vyasadeva states very clearly that there is no room for materially motivated religions within the Srimad Bhagavatam. All the different stories which are brought about within the conversation among the sages are only meant for the purification of the devotee and those who are eager to hear. Otherwise, if one tries to go through the pages of the Srimad Bhagavatam to find excuses or to find a justification to authorize another opportunity for sense gratification, one will fail automatically and one will cheat oneself. And I'm making that point because it's important to set our mind with the right motive and the right intention when we study Srila Prabhupada's books. Even though Prabhupada took so much endeavor, so much effort, so much sacrifice to translate these books and to make them available for the whole world, he said how he primarily wrote them for his disciples and his followers. So when we look at the story of King Puranjan, it's like looking at oneself in a mirror. Like in the morning, there's one thing we don't like to do is look at ourselves in a mirror because it's not a very pretty scene. Maybe after we've taken a shower, it looks a bit better. And maybe after we've put tilak on, it looks even better than that. But normally when we wake up in the morning, we wake up with heavy layers of ignorance. Either if we had a very deep sleep, and we have difficulty to wake up, to open our eyes, or our sleep was riddled with dreams. We wake up and we try to figure out what happened. And then we face a situation where we try to see what is the reality and what is not the reality. Prabhupada here in the purport mentions dreams, svapna, as one state of consciousness. So, dream is an interesting thing because Prabhupada did say that dreams are absolute illusion. Shri Shri Gaunitai, Shri Shri Krishna Balaram, Shri Shri Radha, Shamasunda Lalita Vishaka, Ki Jai. Dreams are an illusion. What are dreams made of? Dreams are made of thoughts and desires. Of course, we can do anything with our mind. We can think of anything without anyone knowing about it. Just like right now, some of you are attentive to what I said, but others are probably having breakfast or wondering, what am I going to do during the day? Or did I pay my bills before I came to Vrindavan? Or what about my kids? Or, you know, I've got to meet with this one and that. Oh yes, it's Srimad Bhagavatam class. I've got to pay attention. So we have unlimited thoughts that travels our mind constantly and build up a state of consciousness. This is why meditation on the yoga platform is very essential, because it teaches the mind to be disciplined. So yoga, it's not just for yoga students to practice yoga, asana, astanga yoga. Yoga, for bhakti yoga, even though it's a very active thing, it requires discipline and mental concentration. So we have all sorts of thoughts that forms a consciousness and a pattern. And then we have to deal with all this. Either we can reject them, ignore them, file them, classify them, label them, and then work with them. This is what Krishna means in Bhagavad Gita, that the mind can be the best friend of one world's enemy. It just depends on the deal that we make with the mind. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati said, what do you do with the mind when you get up in the morning? Is it the stick or the shoe? It's the shoe. The shoe 100 times on the head, and before you go to sleep, to make sure you got to have a sound sleep. In other words, knock yourself out and beat your mind with a stick 100 times. And then there are the object of the senses, what we see with our eyes, which transform into a thinking pattern. That's also very important. Let's say when we're a devotee, let's say a devotee who lives in Vrindavan, who lives in the ashram, or does service here in the Holy Dham, you can imagine what is the thinking process and the sight for the eyes and the sound vibration for the ears. There is so much opportunity to fill one's mind and one's senses with pure Krishna consciousness if one wants to. Of course, it's getting harder and harder. For example, I was telling someone the other day, I went for darshan at the Radharaman temple. I was in the spiritual world. Then I went for darshan of Radha Shama Sundar, and I was in the spiritual world. And then I went to Radha Damodar for darshan, and I was in the spiritual world. And then to come back to the Krishna Balaram Mandir, I went through hell. Pure, condensed hell. So this is sense perception. Now some devotee says, no, you're getting old, you're not tolerant to the beautiful noise of the honking cars and the motorbikes. You have to tolerate, it's the Holy Dham. Well, sorry, it's not. It's an absolute intrusion, an aggressive transaction on the mind of the devotees who come to the Holy Dham to find peace, inspiration, and recharge their batteries. And this is very important, because we think, oh, I am in Vrindavan, I have every opportunity to absorb myself and all my senses and fill my mind, make it like a lake, so that the swan of Krishna consciousness can swim freely. But as soon as you step out the door, it's Kali Yuga. And it's very, very difficult. I told some devotees, I'm going to take a break from the 1.5 billion Chinese that I live in the midst of during the year, and I'll take a break, I'll go to India. Well, wrong destination, man. Very, very difficult. Anyway, each of us are confronted with decision-making in terms of absorbing oneself and making the mind filled with thoughts of Krishna consciousness. And this is very, very difficult. If it's difficult for us, you can imagine how difficult it is for somebody like King Puranjana, who, as mentioned here, whether at the stage called Jagrata, which is a life of awakening. What does that mean, the life of awakening? It means that we live in the world. And when we live in the world, we're on the battlefield. It's a constant battle for the mind, the senses, the intelligence, the ego. And we are always faced with making decisions about who we are. And this is what the whole story of King Puranjana is about, is who we are. Each of us is a city with 9 gates, with parks and lakes and forests. And they are beautiful damsels who walk about, not the ladies who walk about, the ladies who walk about in here and in the heart. And we have to deal with that lifestyle. So again, when we are situated very comfortably in Krishna consciousness, we have a chance to actually make this city quite livable. And that's what Prabhupada gave us. He gave us a lifestyle. This is why Prabhupada was like a teacher, a friend, a father, a grandfather, a great-grandfather. And the older you get, the more attention you give to the children. You're more merciful, you're more tolerant, you're more compassionate. How was Prabhupada that way? Prabhupada taught the devotees how to eat, how to sleep, how to bathe, how to dress, how to speak, how to preach, how to cook, how to dress the deities, how to worship, how to do everything. Molded, soft clay. Right? The potter uses water and clay and then start fashioning in any shape until it gets into the oven. That's brahmacharya. Brahmacharis, brahmacharinis, they learn all these things, and because normally they're young, they're pliable. We taught when we moved to the temple to leave the false ego at the door. But oftentimes we bring it in and we keep it in a bag somewhere. Say, hey, I'm not done yet. But still we go through the training. And we have to be careful because that training oftentimes, 20 years down the line, is resented. I was taught to do this, I was taught to do that, I was forced to do this, I was forced to do that. But if we have a little bit of intelligence, we'll see that that primary training is actually it's like laying cement when we build a house. Later on, we are very appreciative. Just like when we're children, there's certain things our mother cooks that we hate to eat, but when we're an adult, we love it. So similarly, the training that Srila Prabhupada has given us may be painful. We may resent it, but actually looking deep inside, we understand that it's extremely helpful for the rest of our life. In the Vedic system, that's what it's all about. The different samskaras are there to help the human being to go through the different stages and be protected. Here, King Puranjan has no protection whatsoever. Anything goes, anything is good. And of course, out of all the good things in life, the most relishable, the most pleasurable is the association with the opposite sex, with women. Now, this section of the Srimad Bhagavatam, especially this story, seem not to be very kind towards women. I mean, one verse after another, it seems like it's the woman's fault. Everything is the woman's fault. But Prabhupada is very clear on the fact that if you are Krishna conscious, there is no male and female, there is no man and woman. Everyone, he is on an equal footing to attain pure devotional service. This is for people who are in illusion. And at this point of the Srimad Bhagavatam, we are still in illusion. There is no chance not to pretend. There's no need to pretend. Each of us, to a lower or higher degree, is very strongly affected by the modes of material nature and by the desire to enjoy the association of women. So, we have to be honest with oneself. We have to face the reality that it's not going away. And it's pointed out at the end of the purport. Even when we are old, and it's interesting because when there are weaknesses in the material world, it's never the woman who's weak, it's always the man who's weak. You'll never see that, oh, an old lady, even at the time of death, will look at a young man and still have sexual attraction. It's never like that. It's always the old man who's attracted. So Prabhupada mentions the old man, even at the fag end of life, even when he's very old, still hanging on, maybe there's one more chance. With what? With my eyes. With the sight of a beautiful woman, which will do what? With my eyesight, I can create a fantasy. Now the mind is active. From the moment that we fall into this material pool until we are able to get out of the material world, the mind never stops. Never. And that's why we dream at night. The mind is at work. What we see with our eyes, what we think with our thoughts, fashions some illusory situation. And that Prabhupada says it's an illusion. Now Prabhupada says if you dream of the pure devotee, that's not illusion. That's factual. So there is a story that illustrates this situation of the old man. Prabhupada, I read in a conversation this morning. Prabhupada talks about Akbar, the great emperor Akbar and his minister Birbal. And he asked Birbal, he says, when does those lusty desires go away? At what point in life? 50? 60? 70? 100? There are yogis in, you meet at Kumbh Mela or in Appendim at 250 years old. Do they still have lusty desires? What's the name of that Muni who was meditating? Subari Muni. How many years did he meditate under the water? 60,000. Not 60 days, not 60 hours, not 60,000 years. Opens his eyes, sees two fish mating. I want. So, Emperor Akbar asks his minister, when does he's gonna stop these lusty desires? He said, never stops. How can it never stop? It's not possible. It has to stop at some point. He says, no, I'll show you. So he brings him to the bed of a dying man and he says, bring your young daughter with you. And you'll see what happens. So the dying man, you know, the dying man is a dying man. You know. And then the young daughter walks in. Prana, suddenly I have life again. Suddenly I'm thinking, hey, I can still do it. You know, you start believing, hey, I'm healthy, I'm not dying. I can dye my hair. I can get my face done. I can go to the gym. I have money. I have influence. I can still do it. And people do it. There's big names out there in the material world. You get married at 75 with someone who's 25. They can still do it. Of course, we know what the woman is in for. There's a lot of money in the bank. But we have that illusion. And why is that illusion there? Because I am in control. Even though we're falling apart, we're hanging on to one last chance to be in control until death comes and takes everything away. What does Prabhupada say? Your bank balance, your buildings, your family, everything. You get up and get out. Finish. It's over. So, the stage of awakening and the stage of dreaming, svapna, and where am I? And jagrata. One stage is called jagrata, a life of awakening, and another is called svapna, the life of dream. What is the difference between the stage of awakening and the stage of dreaming? There is no difference. That's what we call daydream. Isn't it? Daydream. Who's dreaming? Anyone who is not purely Krishna conscious is dreaming to one level or another. It's just a dream. And that we see everywhere, wherever we go, we see people just running after a dream. And you feel like saying, stop! Huh? Hare Krishna. Huh? And it's very hard to wake people up. Very, very difficult to wake people up. People do not want to wake up, whether they have wide open eyes or whether they are sleeping or snoring. Here it says, the man who is very fatigued. Now, Prabhupada here makes the difference between, obviously, the wealthy man and the poor man. So the poor man works really, really hard. What does he do at night? He just lies down and just collapses out of exhaustion and sleeps and snores deeply. Now, someone who has money is thinking, why should I go to sleep when I can enjoy? Even though I'm very tired, I'm not going to go to bed right now. I have a beautiful property. I have a pool, or my house is by the river, so I'm just going to go and crash. Because actually, if you go, before you go to bed, if you actually take a bath or you relax, you actually relax very nicely. You may even fall asleep in the water. But here you're not going to fall asleep because you are surrounded by women. What does that mean? It means you're being entertained. And you think, the night is young. I don't need to sleep. I'll just relax by being entertained. And if this is mentioned in the Srimad Bhagavatam, which was spoken thousands and thousands of years ago, and the same takes place today, you can see factory workers, they just, even the rickshaw wallahs, even anywhere in India, you see people, they can sleep anywhere. I remember one time, was here in 1982, we were invited to a big parade in Farukabad. We went with Burijan Prabhu and then Ayodhyapati Prabhu, Bibi Govinda Maharaj, and the whole Gurukul went. And we were asked to go on the parade, so we had the Harinam party, of course. And they had different carts with different deities. And each cart is energized and has electricity with a generator at the back. And each generator belongs to one family. So that you can have neon lamps and you can carry, you know, in front of the cart. Everybody is carrying some lamps. And the generator is on full blast. It makes so much noise. And I still remember the children of the man who owned the generator, they were sleeping around the generator. I mean, they were sleeping sound. It's like, deep sleep. Nothing will disturb. A rich man, on the other hand, somewhere in California, will need Prozac and all sorts of tablets to fall asleep at night, even though they have everything they can afford. So, whether it's dreaming, whether it's an awakening state, it's all dreaming. It's all illusion. Because everything, including ourselves, including our mind, will at some point collapse and disappear. And especially now, nowadays, we can see how people are racing, literally blindfolded, with the strong desire to put their hands on sense enjoyment because of the free market, because of the economy. And it's also quite ironic to see that those who have set the trend on the other side of the world with sense enjoyment are now becoming the beggars. And those who have learned from them are now in a full pursuit of sense gratification. But we have to pause here and try to understand something which is very, very interesting. Those who have been advertising and been the kings of sense gratification have basically no culture and no tradition. And they have injected those who have a culture and a tradition with sense enjoyment. Now, what is the result of that? What you see today in India. Before I came, I was watching on the video cam when Indrajumna Swami gave a lecture just a few weeks ago. I think it was his first lecture when he arrived here. And he talked about the condition in India, how the shopping malls are being erected, how people are buying so many cars, buying properties. The same people who grew up in a beautiful Vedic system with tradition and culture, who totally blindly are willing to just push it aside to imitate other fools. You know, it's like children at Christmas time, they make a list, wish list to Santa Claus, what they want. They want to be dressed like a cowboy. They want to be dressed like an Indian. They want to be dressed like a nurse. They want to be dressed like a fighter, like Superman. So now those Asian countries who are holding the treasure of proper culture for human beings are now, you know, going with their wish list. I want to have one car, two cars, three cars. I want to have big properties. I want lots of money. And what do? They literally trash their own country. They trash their own culture. They trash their own tradition. It's very, very sad, actually. It's not even upsetting. It's sad. And there is this sense of selfishness that it's my property. How do you see it? You watch people. I mean, all over India, not just in Vrindavan. You watch people, how they clean their courtyards, how they clean their own homes. And then everything is pushed out on the street. Now, who will clean the street? Nobody. No one will clean the street. It's not my street. I didn't buy it. It's not my property. Why should it be clean? And then when we walk down the street, we think, well, this is what people do with their tradition. They trash it. So when we move beyond the heights of the Himalayas, we enter the big land of China. Now, what do we see in China? We see a population who will literally give up sleep in pursuit of sense gratification, with no identity, no interest in having an identity, but just to enjoy without even any knowledge of the consequences. And how do you wake up people from a dream, which is actually not a dream? What is it? If it's not a dream, what is it? It's a nightmare, right? It's an absolute nightmare. So when you go into the cities in China, you think, wow, it's so clean, it's so structured, it's so organized, it's so scheduled, it's so neat, it's so well managed. But for what purpose? To establish the foundation of a beautiful nightmare that everyone is free to grab. So we have to spread Krishna consciousness. I was trying to think of what is the essence of this particular verse. For me personally, I think that to practice Krishna consciousness, there are two prongs. One is we have the responsibility, at least out of appreciation for Srila Prabhupada, to become Krishna conscious. And that is done through our daily sadhana. A devotee is by essence a sadhaka, which means we have to chant Hare Krishna, not because we have promised at the time of initiation, no, because we want to chant Hare Krishna because we love Krishna. And even if we don't have love for Krishna, we chant in order to develop love for Krishna. And we pray to the deities, to the spiritual master, to the Vaishnavas, to the holy Dham, to one day get some taste for the holy name. To be granted one day a chance to serve the divine couple. This is what sadhana is about. At the beginning, it's rules and regulation with the aim and the objective to actually develop some taste. We don't belong here. We belong with Radha and Krishna, with Krishna Balaram, with Lord Chaitanya, Lord Nityananda. This is where we belong. But at the same time, we cannot ignore the world that we live in. And we can also not ignore the fact that before we came to Krishna consciousness, we were just part of the same crowd. We were all daydreaming. We were all living an absolute nightmare. And we can't just go in one direction, the direction of the Bhajanandis. We have to take the direction of the ghost Chanandis, who are at the same time sadhakas and at the same time preachers. And every devotee who has joined the Krishna consciousness movement must feel this very strongly within the heart, that there is no other way to repay the acharyas than by giving Krishna consciousness to others, no matter what it takes, no matter what is our ability, our capacity, our experience, our expertise, even if it's just to clean. That is one little step, like the little spiders who were contributing to building the bridge between Rameshwaram and Lanka. And the monkeys carrying the big boulders say, "Hey, step out of the way, I'm doing big work." And Ram says, "No, no, no, they're pushing the sand." So no one can say, "What am I contributing to the preaching movement?" Every devotee who has affiliated himself or herself with the Krishna consciousness movement is by nature a preacher. Either front line, middle line, or back line. Some people can do it all. Some front line preachers can be very good sadhakas. I mean, they have to be good sadhakas in order to be in the front line. Even though Prabhupada said, man will fall. On the battlefield, you have to expect man to fall. But still it is to their credit that they've actually tried. But then there are others who can't just be frontline, they also have to be the backup. So there is room for everyone. And then you have those who stay right at the back, who stay in the camp, who prepare the food, who polish the shoes, who clean the weapons, who prepare everything for the frontliners. And then you have all those who do the supplying, those who don't know. There's so many people, like Prabhupada once said about the Ford cars. He said, all the people who work in the production line to make those cars that ultimately become Sankirtan vans, they all benefit. So you can imagine, I mean, it's just like, it just expands. How many people on a remote level, knowing or unknowingly, contribute to the Sankirtan movement. And even though it may be Agata Sukriti, they will get the benefit and gradually come closer and closer and closer to Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And how does that happen? Only if we step out the door to make it happen. That's the only way it will happen. And that should be part of our meditation. Our meditation should be our sadhana. Just like breathing air, a devotee should be a sadhaka. And then to pray to Srila Prabhupada, how can I contribute to help you spread this Krishna consciousness movement? To take people and just, hey, oh, Hare Krishna. They don't want the book, give prasadam. They don't want prasadam, give them the holy name. They don't want the holy name, give them your company, your association, talk to them. Talk about their problem, their family, their kids, their profession, anything, so they can become your friends, so they see, hey, you're not like everyone else. You pay attention to me, what's going on? You're kind, you have time, you're tolerant. Well, these are all qualities which expand from sadhana. Titikshava, karunika, suridam, sarvadehinam. These are that quality of devotee. It's not just to share it with other devotees. This is for the masses of, for the population at large. People can pick it up. Sometimes devotees, they find a job, they sit in an office and everyone else can see, this person is not like everyone else. And before they know it, prasadam comes into the office, books come into the office, and people join. That should be, you know, like you put a computer chip into a hardware. There should be that computer chip into our mind. I am a contributor to Prabhupada's movement. My work is to somehow or other help people wake up to their true identity. It doesn't matter how long it's going to take. This is not for us to judge, to calculate, to control, or to plan. Lord Chaitanya, just like Krishna tells Arjuna, this battle is already over. I've already decided who's going to die and who's going to live. Now, who wants the credit? Anyone, put your hand up. Who wants the credit? Arjuna, well, okay, I'll do it. So it's the same. Lord Chaitanya came. He broke open the door, love of God. And then he distributed the fruits only to the people of Bengal and Orissa and a few people in South India? No. They've gone everywhere, all over the world. Now we have to find those fruits and just give them out. Now, who wants the credit? There is such a deep and strong philosophy that is given by the acharyas. They all came here, they sat down, they performed sacrifices, tapasya. The Goswamis wrote so many books. At the same time, they performed their own sadhana. But those books were written with such a broad vision for the people in the future. So, at the same time, you have Chaitanya Mahaprabhu with Bhaktivinoda Thakur, who says, Jiv Jago, Jiv Jago, Gora Chanda Bhole, Kota Nidra Jayo Maya Pisachira Kole. It's very simple. Wake up, sleeping soul. Wake up, sleeping soul. Right? You've been sleeping in the lap of Maya. Now take up to the holy name. That's all there is. And that's all there is to do. In whatever form, we have to give the holy name. So that's the essence of how we contrast ourselves and don't want to become a Puranjana. Make a good use of our body, mind, and senses. And as someone mentioned in a class here a few days ago, instrument. Nothing else but being an instrument. Either a scalpel or a bell to wake people up. We go to the spiritual master and we become instruments. What do you want me to do? How do you want me to do it? Where? When? And the guru gives the instruction. And that's it. The instruments begins to work. We are only instruments in the hands of the guru parampara. And when you look at that identity, forget about men and women. Forget about male and female. Forget about these plans to be in the association of the female so you can feel yourself really advanced materially, in control for whatever, how long it's going to last. There's no such a thing. And it's very difficult because in our Krishna consciousness movement, male and female have to mix all the time. All the time. And it's a great test to actually learn to see. Like Prabhupada said, you should see every woman as your own mother. Because if you don't, you're going to see her in many other ways. And it's not going to work. So we see the ladies as ladies to start with. That's why we call them ladies. We may call them Matajis, but Mataji, you know, it's a local terminology. Actually, the ladies. And ladies have the same potential. We have to have mutual respect because they have the same, if not a bigger potential to spread Krishna consciousness as we do. Prabhupada has proven that with his own disciples. And there are so many ladies who have achieved so much that can show us that they should be supported and encouraged and not exploited as Puranjana is trying to do. Okay, I'll stop here. Thank you very much. Are there any questions? Yes? Did you hear the question? When we see everyone as mother, do these ladies must act as mothers? Or we should just consider them as mothers? Well, every woman by nature is meant to be a mother. May not or may not be a mother, may have been a mother, but everyone is considered a mother. But why a mother? Because there are inherent qualities that a mother has. And one of them is security and affection and duty and responsibility and chastity. So we have to respect that in any woman. As a matter of fact, whether they are devotees or not devotees, any woman. Who told the story the other day of the, was it Prabhupada Katha? Oh yeah, Vyasakipur. How Prabhupada respected the cleaning lady who was waiting by the door in Bombay. He says, now the authority has walked in, we have to adjourn. And you'll find actually that when there are either divorce or separation or split between a man and a woman, the women are much stronger than men. So we have to acknowledge the fact that there is strength there. Don't forget, this is their kingdom, not ours. This is their field, not ours. Yeah, it helps. Yes. Intelligence is based on Shastra. We don't have intelligence. Our intelligence is based on sense perception. In other words, we're just a machine. And that machine sees, hears, smells, touches, everything. And then based on that experience, it draws conclusion. That conclusion becomes knowledge. Now we have to choose. Do I want that knowledge that constantly shows me that it's not going to work? That it's fallible? That it's temporary? Or do I want a piece of intelligence that shows me that there is a way out of this? It's not easy, but it's the way out. So intelligence comes from scriptures. And comes from the teachings of those who have managed to use the intelligence for the elevation into Krishna consciousness. So we learn from the masters how to use our intelligence. Buddhi yoga is intelligence applied in devotional service. When we are engaged, and this is it seems to be kind of common sense. But you'll find that for some devotees, the concept of devotional service is not very clear. Some devotees may think, well, I'm a devotee, so automatically I make spiritual advancement. No, it doesn't work that way. There has to be practical service. I mean, practical means hands, feet, legs, torso, head, arms, engage in practical service. This is why Maharaj Ambarish attained perfection. Because he engaged every limb of his body and his mind in Krishna's service. He used his leg to walk to the temple. He used his hand to wash the temple. He used his mouth to preach Krishna consciousness and hear Krishna Katha. He used every particle of his body in practical devotional service. This is why Prabhupada established temples. Because if Prabhupada did not establish temples, boy, where were we today? Where would we be today? Prabhupada knew we are not able to sit and chant all day long. It's not possible. It's not going to work. Unless we have the punya. Unless we have the purity at heart. Unless we're born in a Vaishnava family. And even then, you can see all the Vaishnava families are all engaged in devotional service. Why is that? Because devotional service, even if it is conditioned now, that same service is going to be performed on a liberated platform. It's exactly the same thing. It's not like we get to the spiritual world and we do something totally different. This is the spiritual world, we just don't see it. So that's intelligence. Intelligence is to use body, mind, and senses in practical devotional service. Cook, clean, wash, work, do things, not just sit and contemplate. Idle mind is a devil's workshop. Yes, Prabhu? Someone who has an accident? You mean coma? In coma. Did you hear the question? Who wakes up a person who is in coma? Or what wakes up a person in coma? Well, coma is a physical, clinical condition. Either you are in a coma, forced coma, or an induced coma. Sometimes you have to have an induced coma in order for an operation, surgery to take place. But oftentimes people fall into a coma because of a very, very strong physical shock. Like, for example, the ex-Prime Minister of Israel, Ariel Sharon, he's been in a coma for what? I don't know, 20 years or something. He's still in a coma. They don't want to wake him up. Otherwise he dies. Anyway, how do you wake up a person from a coma? Well, like I say, it's a clinical condition. So you cannot control a coma unless the person is ready to come out of it physically. But the good thing is that coma doesn't mean that you are not conscious. You're actually very conscious because the soul perceives. The soul is always active. So the chanting, the hearing is always beneficial for someone in a comatic condition. Yeah, the Mayavadis are saying so many things. Sushupti is liberated stage, like the Buddhists also. They also, this is liberated stage. When there is no more karma, no more action, no more desires. I heard yesterday a lecture, Srila Prabhupada says, people who actually seek liberation is a very subtle form of sense gratification. Why? Because it's selfish. It's very, to want liberation is selfish. Isn't it? I want to be liberated. I've had enough of this material world. Is this about Krishna? Is this about the pleasure of Krishna's senses? Rishikesha Rishikenam Sevanam Bhakti Ruchate. This has got nothing to do with Krishna. This has got nothing to do with devotional service. This is all about me. Okay, if it's about you, you don't want to have desires, you don't want to engage in practical activities, but you want to be liberated, I'll put you somewhere where you have a perfect environment. Nirvishesha. Sunyavad. Nothing. And Prabhupada characterizes this as what? Spiritual suicide. You get out of the entanglement of this material world, but you don't get into devotional service. So it's a spiritual suicide. And Prabhupada says, what happened to these people? They have to come back again. And what do? Altruistic activities. Hospitals, charities, because they can't even... Why is that? Because they think, okay, I've tried that. I've tried Sunyavad, it didn't work. So let me do something practical. Now watch this. What does that mean, practical? It's still all about me. I will not make a step to say, Krishna, I am yours. I will not do that. Now when you spend a little bit of time with the Mayavadis and the so-called charitable organization in India, you'll see it is right in your face. As a devotee, when you have that knowledge, you can pick on it straight away. Recently in Rishikesh, we've seen that in full display. With great Mahant who gathered together for a big celebration. They were all delegation of so many sages and big Mahants. And it's all about, you know, the eye hospital and the shoulder hospital and the foot hospital and helping the poor, which is very good. But don't do it on the plea of spiritualism. that serving man is serving God. Prabhupada was very strong on this. Very, very strong. Practical devotional service is the way to liberation. But the devotee is not even interested in this. Nectar devotion, in the first few chapters, this is mentioned, the five different types of liberation. The devotee has no interest. Why? Because the devotee doesn't care whether he is here or there, as long as he or she is engaged in devotional service. That is liberation. That is the real liberation. It's not a dream, it's practical. It's very, very practical. Why? Because there is a change of heart. Instead of a change of mind, there is a change of heart. That is the difference. There is ecstasy, ultimately. There is bhav. You show me Mayavadi having bhav. There's no bhav. Hare Krishna. Anything else? Mataji? We have to, you know, knowledge is not just for anybody. Even though Prabhupada made it so simple, I mean, if you look at Prabhupada's English or even his own purport, they're actually fairly simple. So anyone with a little bit of education, read Prabhupada's books, will find logic. And Prabhupada talks to us in his purports. And he engages us. He says, okay, you have understood that point, now practice it. So we have to, you know, it requires, there's no such a thing as an easy path in Krishna consciousness. It requires discipline. There's no way out. Even the biggest materialists will not be successful unless they have discipline, concentration and focus, commitment and determination. Sportsmen will have it, politicians will have it, big business people will have it. So why not sadhus? We need determination, strength, commitment, focus, discipline. Even for the smallest thing that we have to do as soon as we get up in the morning. So without that, it will be very difficult to actually understand how to apply the knowledge that we receive. So it takes practice. We grow into it. It becomes a lifestyle. Then once we move into this lifestyle, we become identified with the extension of the knowledge. Hey, now I can see things as they are. So then you can engage without the mind giving you trouble. You feel more confident. You feel stronger. So yes, I can do this. Yes, I don't have to identify with this. Yes, I can avoid this. Yes, I can engage with this. So it's like having weapons. Life is a battle. You need weapons. Without the weapons, we can't fight. We just fall. And we lose. And a lot of people lose. Every day they lose. It's the survival of the fittest. Materially speaking and spiritually speaking. It's a battle. There's no way out. It is a battle. Like what I said before. Knock your mind off with a pair of shoes in the morning, with a stick in the evening. Otherwise, computer game, on the phone all the time, on the computer, on the internet, chatting this and that, going shopping, I need this, I need that, and then you just let loose. And before you know it, you have no idea who you are, you have no idea what you're doing, and you don't know what is the purpose of life. End of the story. Simple as that. You can see it. You don't even have to watch TV. You can see it every day around you. Every day it takes place. People are totally and utterly out of control. And they're being manipulated, especially with electronics. I mean, it's just amazing. Even sometimes I see devotees, even in the temple room, even when they have a conversation, as soon as the phone rings, without thinking twice, they pick it up and they answer it. They don't even know who's calling. Give it up. Turn it off. Finished. Yes, Prabhu. We're out of time. Thank you. Gantara Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai.